Throughout the month of October, your multi-award-winning local radio station will be celebrating Black History Month with an array of news, views, discussions and documentaries that will showcase some of those who have made their mark on our lives.
There can be no question that Speer built big, and he certainly impressed the hundreds of thousands of impressionables who attended the week-long September rallies in a state of impressed delirium.
He stage-managed mass mesmerism, mass enchantment and the central right of the party, in which Hitler brought the blood flag of the Nazi martyrs into contact with all the other flags, in a gesture that has been compared with that of a cattle breeder.
Speer, though, has many devotees, the Speer carriers, the keepers of the toxic flame. Chief among them is one Leon Krier, a man who genuinely believes that Speer is the greatest architect of the 20th century. This is a piffling opinion and would be of absolutely no moment were it not for the fact that Krier is one of the chief architectural advisors to the Prince of Wales.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. We follow the money trail. Who made a killing out of the deaths of 3,000 or so New Yorkers on 9/11? Part two of my interview from Buenos Aires with British journalist Lawrence DeMello this week. Also, were the 7/7 suicide bombers trained by British special forces? And were warnings sent to West Yorkshire Police 2 years before the attacks ignored? Also, harrowing stuff, a lot of people don't want to go there, but we hear tonight from Geoffrey Dickens MP. He's the MP who handed the lost VI paedophile dossier to Tory Home Secretary Leon Britton back in the 1980s. We hear from him last night speaking on Australian television at the time. Plus Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. We start this week with the Avon and Bristol Law Centre, and Will Stones here from there. Hi, Will. Welcome to the Politics Show. First of all, the national minimum wage up from to £6.70 an hour from October, and the living wage to be introduced in April. That's £7.20. But I mean, what's the reality? How enforceable is this? And is this really a living wage?
Well, the national minimum wage goes up every October. It's gone up by the usual very small pittance of an amount, £6.70 from £6.50 from the beginning of this month. There's going to be a further hike in April to £7.20. However, that only applies to people over the age of 25. So the new provisions with regards to living wage are not going to apply to people under 25. So if you're aged between 21 and 25, you'll still just get the national minimum wage, I would imagine, of £6.70. Under 21, it goes down until by the time you're about 16, it's only about £3.50. I understand also that the wage for apprentices has gone up to something like £3.30 this month as well, so not a lot.
Aren't these apprentice schemes often being used by companies, though, just simply to employ people that they're not paying the proper wages to?
I have come across cases like that. I've had people phoning me where they say that their employer has them on an apprentice scheme. When you then ask them about, well, OK, well, who's the training provider? What does your apprentice contract say? They say, oh, I haven't got anything like that. I don't go to any provider. The problem that always arises is that when we then advise people, well, hang on a minute, you are entitled to a national minimum wage here, that is not a genuine apprenticeship, we can take it up for you, we can take it further with your employer, then usually it's usually quite a young person, you know, 16 or 17, then says, oh, well, hang on a minute, I don't know if I want to cause any trouble, because I'm actually, you know, it may be that they're working at a garage, they are actually learning something, they want to keep in with the person who's employing them in the hope that they will get a proper job in the future, and so they're kind of a little bit scared off taking any kind of legal action.
That's right. I mean, if someone, it may even be paying half what the minimum, being paid half the minimum wage, they're afraid to lose even that job. So the minimum wage, Martin, I'm going to bring you in here, almost starts to mean not a lot.
No, it's a fig leaf, isn't it, for the increasing exploitation of ordinary folk. I mean, real wages haven't risen in this country for a very long time. In the United States of America, by some studies, they haven't risen since 1973. So that's the reality.
Will, what can you do if someone is prepared to take this sort of thing to court? Because the employer is simply going to say, well, if you're going to take me to court, I want nothing more to do with you, thank you very much.
Well, what you can do is to take a claim out in the employment tribunals, and the tools that you have there are actually quite good, because they're the kind of things that employers don't want. One of the things that you can do once you've got your claim in to an employment tribunal is to get an order from the tribunal that employer releases their wage records to you to prove exactly what they've been paying you. Now, a lot of particularly small businesses don't particularly want somebody from the Inland Revenue or a lawyer from Navan and Bristol Law Centre looking over their wage records, and so there is a good chance that you may be able to come to some sort of a settlement agreement with them. That agreement may also obviously include that the employer isn't allowed to talk about your case, which means that you're not going to necessarily be prejudiced by other employers.
Now, I can remember when I was working back in, 1990, 1991, what's that, 25 years ago pretty much, getting paid £10 an hour. That was considered a sort of reasonable amount at the time, and I was in my late 20s, early 30s. Now it seems that the minimum wage is even less. And when we talk about a living wage, is there any actual evidence that you can live on it?
Well, I think the living wage came from possibly one of the low pay unit actually calculated that was, it's not a living wage, but it's the minimum amount that somebody could possibly be able to live off if they were working a full working week. So it's not strictly speaking a living wage, it's just a minimum wage. And you're absolutely right. I mean, the living wage that the government's now talking about is going to go up to £9 by, I think, 2017, by which of course inflation may well mean that it is no longer even commensurable with the living wage as is going to be set next year.
Martin, let's bring you in again here, because the power has shifted. We were mentioning this last week between the employer and employee, where the employers seem to be able to get rid of staff very, very much more easily than they used to be able to, and also to pay them way less than even the minimum wage we're hearing there. So what's going on here, and how does this relate to the macroeconomics and the global economy? What's going on?
Well, if you go in the period from 1945 to about 1973, in a capitalist economy with technological change, you expect productivity per worker to rise at a fairly regular rate. The usual rate was to be about 3% a year. Now, the productivity has carried on rising, and what used to happen is through collective bargaining, that productivity increase would then be passed on as increased wages, which is what led to increased living standards for ordinary people from 1945 to 1973. When that was broken, and you can look at the statistics online, the ruling classes, if you like, the bosses, were able to break the power of the trade unions to change the balance of power in the labour market. So productivity continues to rise, although in Britain it's stagnating at the minute, but that doesn't get passed on as wage increases. And that's okay, because that means that profits increase, which therefore increases things like rental values and property prices, which is all good for those who own those things. It's very bad for the people who are working. But of course the solution to that was to give people credit. So you end up with people taking out loans to buy the stuff that they used to be able to buy through their wage increases. And that, of course, can work for a while. until you crash. And that's what we're doing now. Ultimately, if you don't pass on productivity increases as wage increases to the workforce, you are basically building a bonfire on which you will be roasted. And that's what's happened.
Will, on to another topic, well, related topic, which is home care workers. Apparently, the courts have clarified that they're entitled to National Minimum Wage, not just for the time that they're actually doing the job, but also travelling between clients and sleeping over. Tell us about that. I mean, you know, I wouldn't necessarily, for example, expect to be paid for going between one place and another just where I'm actually doing the job.
Well, actually, the law in relation to people who are travelling whilst they're working, so perhaps somebody who might be travelling to a meeting or somebody who's travelling to meet a client, for example, has always been the case, particularly with regards to industrial injury legislation. If somebody has an accident in a car when they're driving, you have to have insurance on your car, and that's because the courts have always made it clear that once you're at your place of work, until you are actually on your way home, then you are regarded as in working time. And so care worker who travels to their first client is not in working time, but if they're travelling between clients, they are in working time. When they're travelling home, they're no longer in working time. And all that's happened with the cases that we've seen over the last couple of years, where the courts have consistently said they're entitled to be paid the minimum wage during that travelling time between clients, they're just assessing and applying the law as it always has stood. The same is certainly true with regards to somebody who's sleeping over, for example. It's long been established the case that a security guard who might not be involved in doing any security work, chasing people off the premises or during the time that they're actually in place overnight, for example, at a warehouse, is in working time because they are being vigilant, then the same is true about somebody who is having to sleep over in a care home, for example, or at somebody's house in the event that somebody may need them during the night. Now, many care agencies have said, oh, no, you can only be paid if you actually wake up and actually do something, if you take a cup of tea to your client. The courts have made it clear, no, that's not the case. If the crucial point is, could you pop out and get a pizza during that time? If the answer is, well, no, hang on a minute, what happens if your client needs you during that time? You can't, you've got to be there, then you should be paid.
Sounds like a reasonably good principle. Also, well, it's been looming for a few years now. It's had a few problems on the way, but universal credit apparently is going to be coming to Bristol. Is that right? Has there been a trial recently? Universal credit being this kind of lumping all the benefits into one.
I think there have been trials and tribulations and all sorts of problems in the areas where the pilot scheme has been rolled out across the country, but it is coming to Bristol next week. Not over the whole of Bristol, but certain parts of Bristol. I know Bedminster is one of them. What that means is that people who are currently on a range of benefits, they may be getting some income support, some housing benefit, they may be getting some child tax credit, they may be getting some working tax credit, those are all going to be put into one benefit, which is called universal credit. People will, as I understand it, have some sort of protection to ensure that they don't actually lose out, but what welfare benefits and rights advisors are concerned about is the fact that that universal credit will be capped. So each person will have a particular amount of universal credit that can't be increased. So if they have more children or if their needs become more, that won't be able to be increased. It's just a set amount that everybody will get.
Yes, but I mean, you can understand Osborne's got to cap it somewhere, hasn't he?
Well, it seems that he's doing more than that because he's already taking away some of it. We're not really sure what's going to happen at the moment, but the recent furore in the House of Lords about tax credits, that those tax credits are going to be part of the universal credit. So if he's taking them away, he's already going to be reducing somebody's benefit below the amount that the government says they need to live on as a minimum amount. So it doesn't really make any sense. It's quite confusing. And of course, people always have unplanned for needs, and you need to have a system that's flexible to cope with those needs. I mean, back in the old days, you may remember supplementary benefit, which came in before income support. That those have always been described as safety net benefits. In other words, they're there to catch people to ensure that they don't become destitute, and they're set at the minimum amounts that people can live on with regards to their own particular needs. So there are always amounts that you could put on for people's particular needs. That has been withdrawn over the last 20 or so years, and it appears that it's being withdrawn even more, so that many people on universal credit won't even be on a figure that would be commensurate with those safety net levels as they were 20 years ago.
Now, Martin, isn't national insurance and social security supposed to be there to make sure that people don't fall below that destitute level that Will's talking about there?
Well, it is, yes. I mean, it's not an optional add-on either. Having a comprehensive welfare system that prevents people from falling into poverty also protects the economy against shocks. Just think of what's going to happen in Scunthorpe, where all of these people are going to lose their jobs in the steel industry. They're on good wages at the minute, but if they don't have adequate access to benefits and support, then the local economy in Scunthorpe will fall through the
that's
floor.
That's right, it's going to have a knock-on effect like a house of cards.
So the whole of Scunthorpe. The point of having a decent welfare state is that you can make changes, like we're going to have to change this, we're going to have to close this industry down. Now, I'm not saying for a minute that they should close the steel industry in Scunthorpe, but if you're going to have a capitalist economy where these kind of things can happen, the welfare system is there to make sure that you can actually do that in an effective way without crashing the local economy. And the same thing is true on a national level. So as they soar away at benefits, they're actually making the country more and more vulnerable to a crash. So when a crash comes, if they've actually squeezed all of these benefits down, they will create a situation where the economy will be less able to cope with a crash than it otherwise might be.
But what about towns like Scunthorpe that have been built around a giant steel plant like there, that most of the economy, even people, things like places that are servicing cars, you know, the food shops, these kind of things, are all dependent down the food chain, aren't they, from this steel plant. You're ending up, aren't you, with towns, cities that are actually losing their reason to be there. There's no reason for them to be there
anymore. That's why we probably got to move to, I mean, the basic principle of universal credit, that there should be a basic support for the population, is a good one. But of course it's got to be unconditional support. We should move towards a system which has been discussed in places like Denmark, where everybody is guaranteed a citizen's income, and then they can work on top of that or not, as they choose. And that means that you will accept that some people will just live on their citizens' income and they won't want to work, possibly because they've got mental health issues, whatever it may be. And of course that flexibilises the labour market. At the moment, the problem they've got with the tax credits is that what they're making is that people will not have any incentive to take extra work if it's all going to be taken off them as they earn extra money. And even the Adam Smith Institute has criticised Osborne over tax credits on that basis. And ultimately, the way to resolve this is to give everybody a guaranteed income and then allow them to work on top of that. And of course you could give the same guaranteed income to multimillionaires, they wouldn't even notice.
Yeah,
the,
of
amount,
course.
The amount of money involved is trivial.
And from an administrative point of view, that has actually been shown by various studies to be the cheapest.
Of course it
way
is, because you don't have to assess everybody all the time.
Exactly.
You just say, if you're on the electoral I would say if you're on the electoral register and you can show that you've participated in the election, you're a citizen and therefore you should get a citizen's income.
But what if you just don't want to vote? You have to vote.
Well, you have to. This is what I mean. This is how Athenian democracy used to work. You know, if you are a citizen, you're expected to turn up for the meeting. I mean, that's the that's what you'd say to people, and you could educate children in school. You will get a right to live in this country on a minimum level, but you've got to participate in the political process. And that, of course, then creates a constituency of those who will vote for it, which is what happened in Athens. People were given, poor people were paid to sit on juries and so on. And juries used to have 500, 600 members.
So I suppose what you're saying, Martin, here is that actually modern Britain is actually a step back towards barbarism from Athens.
Well, I mean, the point is, as has been made by Will, it's actually cheaper, because what you'd also do is you'd get rid of things like mortgage tax relief, stuff like that. You consolidate all benefits and tax reliefs into one payment, a citizen's income, which then guarantees every. And of course, what it also does is it gives everybody peace of mind. You know you're going to be all right, whatever. And that means people can then plan their lives confidently, knowing that they're not going to be.
Do the government want people to have peace of
mind? No, they don't, because ultimately, of course, what we're talking about is attempting to keep the 19th century balance of power in place in the 21st century. And of course, it doesn't actually work. As I stressed earlier, squeezing wages down ultimately is self-defeating for modern capitalism. You need rising wages and a workforce that's actually quite capable of enforcing its rights. That's actually an essential part of the system.
So what you are suggesting is an actual massive drop in the number of civil servants to administer a system like this. Surely Osborne and Cameron should go for it without even thinking about it.
Well, I mean, it was originally Milton Friedman who put forward the idea of citizens' income. And of course, what it would lead to is you wouldn't have to have things like job centres, for example. There would be no need for them.
Will, I can't resist but ask you about, I know you're not a criminal lawyer, this headline caught my notice in The Independent again, Nigel Morris, on the 20th of October. More than 100 solicitors' firms are prepared to take the Ministry of Justice to court over the changes. Their anger centres on the shake-up of the system under which solicitors are provided to represent people under arrest in police stations and magistrates' courts. The number of contracts is being cut from 1,600, and pay rates for the work are also being cut. But taking the Ministry of Justice to court, solicitors?
I think that's happened before. I think Chris Grayling, the last minister, was taken to court probably more than any other minister of justice over various things, whether it was the legal aid cuts or whether it was to do with the changes to criminal legal aid. Now, with regards to the changes to criminal legal aid, I'm not a criminal lawyer, so I don't know too much about it, but I know that Michael Gove is causing major problems by constantly backtracking and saying, well, he's not going to bring in these changes, he's going to look at it again and then he'll do something else. And I think what's happened this time is that he's ruffled too many feathers again, and he may well find himself in court. I mean, at the end of the day, criminal legal aid to ensure that every person who is accused and who's put on trial is allowed to have proper representation, to ensure that we can see that the criminal justice system is fair, is transparent and is working, is a right. It's a right that everybody has in this country. And to change it so that you end up with a kind of, I think what somebody was talking about at work with me today, kind of deal or no deal kind of TV type justice, where it's like a lottery, whereas some people will get the best lawyers because they can afford to pay for them, other people will have no lawyers at all and will just be simply dependent on what the mood of the judge or the magistrate or the jury is that day, without having proper representation.
The other thing is the criminal court charges. They've come in recently. I don't know what your experience is of those. Again, this is criminal, I think I'm right, in magistrates' courts. But it does seem a bit strange that somebody with nothing should be asked to pay the same as somebody with plenty of money when they go to a criminal court. The idea also, apparently, is to try and persuade people to plead guilty rather than not guilty. So tell us a bit about those charges.
Well, yes, these were brought in quite quietly in April of this year, and ever since then have, within the magistrates court system particularly, been causing all sorts of problems. 50 magistrates across the country have resigned because they think it's wholly unfair. They can't sit there and impose a fine that they know that somebody is not going to be able to afford to pay on top of all the other fines. We've had cases of people who have said that they have pleaded guilty simply because they didn't want to risk having a higher charge. If you plead guilty at first instance, the charge is £150. If you say, well, okay, I'm innocent and I'm going to opt to have a trial by jury in the Crown Court, if the jury don't agree with you, then that charge increases to £1,200. So it's a huge hike, and it is almost like an extra punitive payment on top of what the punishment that somebody would already be given. So a lot of magistrates, a lot of judges are very unhappy about it. It looks as though it probably will be reviewed in some way within the next 6 months, and let's hope that that will go so that that injustice can then stop. Interestingly enough, one of the things Michael Gove came up with this week as an alternative to that would be to lobby a tax on the huge city firms who are making lots of money out of their financial legal services. That strikes me as being very odd, because I don't think government at the moment would be agreeable to having a charge on private medical services and private hospitals and private GPs to pay for the National Health Service, for instance. But that seems to be the way that Michael Gove is looking at it. Whether he's able to get those law firms on board on that remains to be seen.
Will, just give us an idea of where you are at the Avon and Bristol Law Centre and also the sorts of cases that you can help with.
It's Avon and Bristol Law Centre down in Stokes Croft. I myself deal with employment cases and discrimination cases. I'm particularly interested to hear from people, care workers, who want some advice on national minimum wage issues, or anybody else who wants advice on any employment matter, or if they feel they've been discriminated against, we can deal with that. We also have teams dealing with welfare benefits, dealing with immigration, dealing with community care, and dealing with housing. And you can contact us on our reception number, which is 0117 924 8662. Our website is ablc.org.uk.
okay. Will Stone from Avon and Bristol Law Centre. We have you in here, I think, every 2 or 3 months, don't we? Thanks ever so much for joining us on The Politics Show.
Thank you.
You can listen again to any shows at bcfmradio.com and leave comments about your favourite programmes. BCFM 93.2, your interactive station, 24 hours a day.
Now, were the 7/7 bombings, the alleged bombers anyway, trained by British Special Forces? Well, we heard from Fran Anderson a few months ago, I think it was on the 10th anniversary in July this year. You might be able to go back to thisweek.org.uk and find that show. You can listen to it again about this chap who'd worked for the British Special Forces, the SBS, Special Boat Service, Martin McDade, who was training them. But Martin, there is quite a strange conflagration, wasn't there, going on up in Leeds 2 or 3 years before the London bombings. We're going to hear in a minute from this chap, Martin Gilbertson, who was part of the ICRA bookshop in Leeds, in Beeston. What do you make of the attachment, though, of this chap, Martin McDade, who apparently was taking a couple of the bombers, Khan and Tanweer, I believe, who were also trustees of the ICRA bookshop, over to Cumbria to train them?
Yes, well, he was an ex-Special Boat Squadron guy, and the suspicion has got to be, as in many other cases, that, as we said in the first hour, that Sunni jihadi terrorists have an intimate linkage with Western intelligence services and special forces going back to the 1980s, and therefore, of course, they're then groomed to carry out the attack, which is part of a geopolitical strategy from inside the intelligence services.
Well, we're going to hear now from Channel 4 News report from a couple of years ago, actually, from I think it was 2011, with the inquest into the 7/7 London bombings. I mean, the inquest itself, Martin, was not correct, was it? Because you only have an inquest for an individual death. This was the death of 52 people. If you have a multiple death, then you would normally have a public inquiry. But also, the inquest sat without a jury.
And of course, there was no actual conviction of anybody because the perpetrators were all supposedly dead. Although, in actual fact, the obvious thing to ask is, well, who put them up to it? And of course, that's where the questions start to get really interesting.
Well, the family members of those that died, but many of them were extremely frustrated because they were then told by Lady Justice Hallett, I believe, who was the coroner for that inquest, that they would not be able to ask any questions of the authorities and the security services at that inquest.
Well, indeed, and it fits a pattern of terrorist atrocities which achieve certain political goals, but in which the evidence suggests that the intelligence services were involved. For example, this bombing in Turkey of the peace march the other day, which killed 100 and some odd people. Most people in Turkey believe that was carried out by elements within the state, and that is a NATO-aligned state, just like we are.
Well, let's have a listen to that Channel 4 news report and the voice of Martin Gilbertson, who was working with Tanweer and Khan, two of the alleged London bombers, in the ICRA bookshop in Beeston, in Leeds, in the years running up to the attacks.
In Beeston, Leeds, anti-war campaigner Martin Gilbertson thought he'd found people of like minds when he started working with a young, opinionated community worker, Mohammed Sadiq Khan, and the other local man who had bombed London, Shehzad Tanweer.
I was shocked, and I wonder why nobody listened to me, the police. But I know that other people were talking to the police at the same time. There was many people voicing their concern about what was happening in Beeston, but nobody would listen to anybody.
Martin Gilbertson fell in with MSK and Tanweer because they were working for council-funded projects in the community. He provided the computer skills.
But working in a Muslim shop introduced me to the Muslim community, and I was quite happy to work with the charities because they were all legitimate, funded charities.
Martin Gilbertson was mending computers at the ICRA bookshop, which has now changed hands. The new business has nothing to do with ICRA. He remembers MSK as a normal guy.
It was around about this time I first actually came into contact with Carl. It was not, how do you do, Carl? He was in and out of the shop. He was also a helper for them. He would help people with their Learn Direct stuff.
That was the Channel 4 news report from 2011 there. So what do you make of this?
Well, the suggestion is that the guy who was working in the bookshop, and we know for a fact McDade was an ex-Special Boat Squadron activist, not an activist, a member of the Special Boat Squadron, and he was the one who took them off on weekends training and so on. Now, the suspicion is that all of these terrorist actions, going back to the 1980s, have been orchestrated by elements within NATO's intelligence services. So it fits that pattern.
Also, we were mentioning earlier the inquest. I mean, this does seem to be one of the hallmarks of these sorts of attacks. Can you just take us through what you think are the big questions that when there's a news story of some kind of terrorist attack or a large incident like the one we had in Ankara, for example, where would you look to decide is there something rather more to this than meets the eye? Because, you know, what happens is we get loads and loads of news reports, and then when there's contradictions to those news reports that have happened on the day, often maybe days after, even months or weeks after, then those news reports, we never hear them.
Well, the first point I would make is know the context. The context is that we know for a fact that NATO intelligence services have been involved in commissioning acts of terrorism. For example, the Bologna bombing in 1980 in Italy, various fatal attacks in Turkey, the so-called Egonican networks. Now, when the ISIS suicide bomber, if that's what it was, attacked the Suruk demonstration by the Kurdish political party some months ago, that immediately led to the Kurdish armed militia, the PKK, presuming that the state had been involved in that attack, and they said they killed two policemen. They killed two undercover policemen who they believed were responsible for leading to the attack. Now, the fact is, in the rest of the world, where people have a much more wide sources of information than we do, people understand quite well that when a terrorist attack takes place, you can't presume that you know who did it. And we have documentary evidence going back decades which shows that NATO intelligence services, and not just them but them in particular, have engaged in creating terrorist incidents, major terrorist incidents in which scores and hundreds of people have been killed as part of a geopolitical strategy of tensions. They call it strategia di tensione in Italy. Now, in other words, whenever you hear, just don't presume that you know what's happened, because you'll need to look at all the details over time to draw the correct conclusions, even if you're an investigator, never mind just a general member of the public. But the point is, when we suggest that things like this are orchestrated events, there's a track record for that being the case. And you should presume, I mean, basically I do presume, that these events are orchestrated unless there's evidence to the contrary.
Now, that's 7/7 we were talking about there, which was in 2005. We go back 4 years to 2001 now, to the 9/11 attacks, and part two of my interview with Buenos Aires British journalist Lawrence De Mello, who was following the money trail. Who was it that made a killing out of the deaths of over 3,000 New Yorkers on 9/11?
We have to be so careful, Tony. You're a victim of it at the moment. We've got to be really careful, because if we go over certain lines and say certain things that we know, we're classed as crazies, conspiracy theorists, or we are excommunicated from our colleagues in mainstream media, etc. You were mainstream, I was mainstream. Mm. We both of us sort of veered a bit because we feel that's what's right. That's what journalism should be about, is documenting and passing on good information to the public, and also reveal things which we believe are in the public's interest. I focused on, it's not about who did it. You see, this is where the mistake is. So many people sort of say, who is behind 9/11? Let's forget that. Who was behind Diana's murder? Let's forget it. Let's look at what happened. Look at the event. Was this a genuine building collapse? No, right. Who owned the buildings? What was the insurance policies on the buildings? How were they taken out? That's what you need to look at. So you have to look at the coincidences that surround 9/11, and just one of them, which I took an interest, was how Lawrence Silverstein took out within 3 months before the 9/11 insurance for two buildings for attacks and collapse from commercial airlines. Now, how many buildings in the history of modern construction have we had collapse, those sort of sites from airlines? And plus the fact it's New York. I mean, we know all the story about, you know, the jets coming across, and it's an airspace that should be very, very secure. But he took out that insurance. He made a massive amount of money. And here's the interesting thing about the Twin Towers. The Twin Towers, which were constructed late 60s and 70s, they were riddled with asbestos, Tony. Now, we know about asbestos. We know it's a highly toxic compound that causes cancer. You can't use it anymore. And buildings that were filled with asbestos was used as fireproofing originally. And so those tower blocks were absolutely lined with asbestos. So here was the situation. The Twin Towers needed to be modernized for them to justify the rentals for office space, because they were a white elephant. They were almost empty. They were losing hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars every 6 months. So what did they need to do to encourage people to rent those offices? One, they had to get rid of asbestos. Two, they needed to modernize them. Now, the Port Authority of New York would not permit the demolition of the Twin Towers because of the asbestos content. So that means those towers were not allowed to be demolished, controlled demolition by a construction site to say, okay, we're going to bring these down, we're going to build new buildings. So why would a brilliant developer, Lawrence Silverstein, now if you're a brilliant developer, would you buy a white elephant that has very little occupation? When I'm saying occupation, as in companies occupying space, you're losing money. You're not allowed to develop it because it's full of asbestos. You don't have the permission from the Authority of New York. So why would you do that? And then you invest, you spend your own money, because he got investors, but he also invested his own cash to buy the Twin Towers. So what was he planning to do? You invest millions of dollars into a building that is half empty. Actually, I think it was 30%. It cannot be destroyed. Why would you do that? And then you take out insurance that it's going to be hit by commercial aircraft. The insurance policies more than covered the redevelopment of the whole site. I mean, come on. That is such luck, isn't it? I mean, that's why they call him Lucky Larry. So what happens with 9/11? We get perfect footprint collapse into their own footprint, very tidy, very clean, absolutely demolished. I mean, they didn't even hardly have to take anything away because it was all powder, very dangerous powder, because people are still dying today from that contamination. And what do? They build up these sparkling, amazing offices that are absolutely booming today. So it was a pretty good deal. Is that a coincidence? Do we have a law of averages? I think it's against the law of averages that you buy a building that is a financial loss, total financial, you invest millions and millions and millions, you take out an insurance policy against aircraft. Within 3 months, aircraft just happen to knock those buildings down, and you get billions of dollars in insurance. Pretty cool. So, as I say, I don't want to be, oh, she's a conspiracy nun. I don't care who did it. Well, I do care. But I'm not interested or analyzing who did it. All I'm saying is how it happened. And it couldn't have happened how they said it happened. We've got pilots, scientists, you name it. People have said there is no way those buildings came down due to the burning of the fuel or even the impact of those aircraft into that building. Those steel structures did not come down like that. So what do? That's all been forgotten, of course. Nobody talks about that today. And if you talk about it, of course, you're crazy or whatever. So, you know, this is why I'm saying we need to go back to 1945, because these things are happening all the time. 9/11, Diana, David Kelly, the Malaysian aircraft, the Boston bombings, all these things happen. We all analyze them. Nothing ever comes out. There's never any truth. So I think to enable us to get a control again of our democracy, we need to go back. We need to stop getting sidetracked with what's going on in here, this country, and Libya and Russia and that doing that. This is all to distract us. We need to go back to to the roots and let's look what happened and follow the money and follow the trails and see the individuals that are involved and let's just get rid of them.
Well, that's a fairly succinct summary from Lawrence de Melo there. Of course, the other point I would make is that Building 7 also collapsed, even though a plane didn't crash into it. And coming back to what I was saying earlier, we've got a track record of NATO intelligence services behaving in this kind of way, so that the head of the Italian Supreme Court, Fernando Imposimato, has written a book about this, La Repubblica dei Stragi Sani Impuni, the Republic of the Unpunished Massacres, about all the bombings, shootings and assassinations in Italy in the 70s and the 80s, and he was the investigating magistrate on many of those cases. So we've got a track record of Western intelligence services engaging in terrorism, as uncovered by the Italian police, and that's the first thing that's going to cross your mind when something like this happens. We know that they blew up Bologna railway station in 1980 and killed 80 odd people. What's the moral difference between that and killing 3,000 people on 9/11? And the answer is not much. And the reality is that that's what we're up against.
We are Bristol's first community radio station. BCFM 93.2.
Now on to the subject I mentioned at the top of the hour. This is to do with Geoffrey Dickens MP, and I really have to warn people that there's some very disturbing material in this next report. Do tune out or switch off the radio if you feel a bit over or a bit sensitive about this, and also if there's children around possibly. So this is we heard quite a lot, haven't we? And maybe I'll bring you in this on you too, Martin, about this MP Geoffrey Dickens. In the 1980s, he handed a VI paedophile dossier, it's called, to the Conservative Home Secretary at the Daily on Britain, which was then subsequently lost. And then the former civil servant from the Defence, I think it was Ministry of Defence, Peter Wanless, who went on to run the NSPCC, did an inquiry into lost documents like this, and actually didn't find any.
Well, I mean, what I always say in relation to VIP paedophilia is to mention the Kinkora Boys Home in Northern Ireland, because the allegation there is that MI5 were using the Kinkora Boys Home as a honey trap. They basically encouraged people to go in there, political targets, to have sex with underage boys and then blackmailed them. And I think that's really the iceberg underneath all of this. The paedophilia has been used as a means to blackmail members of the political elite to make sure they stay in line, and that's why it's been covered up for so long.
Well, let's go back to the 1980s now to the Channel 9 programme, still running today, in fact. It's called 60 Minutes, the documentary, very much criticised by the VI paedophile Panorama that came out about 3 weeks ago. And the same programme back in the 1980s spoke to Geoffrey Dickens MP.
And when I spoke out in the House of Commons in London about this, many of the members of Parliament smirked and jeered behind their hands because they were unwilling to believe that such terrible things could be happening. NSPCC, which is our National Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children, their inspectors that look after children at risk all over the country, were reporting that throughout the United Kingdom they were finding evidence of satanic abuse. And so that really reaffirmed what I've been telling the House of Commons.
All Satanists have been abused as children. All. I can't imagine any normal person going into something so horrific, vile, disgusting, so violent, humiliating, could possibly... It's impossible.
Jim Phillips was a doctor of medicine with the police force before he opened his own private practice in Birmingham. Lately, he's more and more focused on victims of abuse in early childhood. He's achieved tremendous results with people who've been regarded hopeless cases within traditional psychotherapy. Perhaps he's most well known for his treatment of patients with multiple personality disorder.
As the children disclosed, I became more and more distressed at what they were telling me, and not a little frightened myself, in fact, because they were telling me things that you only saw in horror films and read in fictitious books.
And so a breakdown in communication, a breakdown in co-working happened in Nottinghamshire. And that became a cause which the nation began to take notice of.
Now, this is back in the 1980s and early 1990s, Martin. There was a lot of talk about this. That was a clip there from the 60 Minutes documentary on the VIP Deval scandal way back in the 80s and 90s on the Channel 9 programme, channel over in Australia. But we're being told, Martin, effectively, that there's really nothing to see here and that the accusations against Leon Britton are baseless.
Well, I don't know whether they're baseless or not, but I think that there's enough evidence for us to investigate thoroughly and to get on top of it. The Kincorra Boys Home scandal has been running for years and has been mentioned for years, and across the political spectrum in Northern Ireland people know that that's probably what was going on there. And my suspicion is that various other children's homes, like Haute La Garenne in Jersey, for example, and the North Wales children's homes, it's an obvious tactic to use. The De Trou affair in Belgium, where he was allowed to operate for years and years and years, because if you're going to commission terrorist acts, you're going to be quite capable of using paedophilia as a political tool. And I would suggest that that is what's behind all of this. We've got manipulation of elites through the use of paedophilia. Once you've got people dirtied up by showing a video of them having sex with an underage person, then they are going to do as they're told. And that's what the purpose behind it all is.
BCFM. And now on to have a look at something for a special one for Halloween. We're going to start by having a listen back to the 1990s again to US talk show host William Cooper, where he explains that the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff that was being appointed by Bill Clinton at the time, whose father was actually a member of the SS.
Don't you dare miss tomorrow night or Wednesday night's episode of The Hour of the Time. If you listen closely tonight, and if you listen closely again tomorrow night, you will know why the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the new chairman appointed by Clinton, lied about his father, whom he said was not really a member of the SS. He was conscripted. There's no such thing as a conscripted member of the SS. Ladies and gentlemen, the man is a liar. He's covering up his father's Nazi past and his willing enlistment in the SS, and therefore must be, probably is, one of the ones who have received the heritage passed down from his father. And I don't believe he would be the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff if he were not a National Socialist. Remember, what you're learning is there really is nothing new under the sun.
Now, Martin, that's a pretty strong allegations being made there, but there are quite clear connections, aren't there, between the Nazis from the Second World War and the United States Security Services.
Indeed. I mean, people like Klaus Barbie, who were wanted by the French authorities as the butcher of Lyon, he was he basically escaped to Latin America and then was eventually employed by the CIA to train the Bolivian army in torture techniques as part of their anti-communist crusade. And I think the evidence suggests that elements of the Reinhard Gehlen, for example, who was the head of the Gestapo in Eastern Europe, ends up as the head of the BND, the West German Intelligence Agency. That's not an accident. That's been going on all along. And a lot of the fascist psychological warfare techniques that NATO has adopted over the years are directly related to the kind of things that the Nazis were pioneering in the 30s. And I think that the linkage is actually well established.
Well, Bill Cooper died. He was shot by the FBI just after the September the 11th attacks. But in the few years running up to them, he had a competitor. That was this guy called Alex Jones. And here's Bill Cooper, also another talk show host. I think Bill Cooper was in Arizona and Bill Jones and Alex Jones was in Texas. But here is Bill Jones exposing Alex Jones. And Alex Jones is talking about Vladimir Putin as when he was first arriving on the political scene.
Vladimir Putin, who is known as Vladimir the Ruthless, and using all his profanity on national TV, you name it. We won't read the profanity here, but we've got it. This person is on an unbelievable power trip and resembles a demon. He is a creature of the IMF and the World Bank and international communism. He is a former KGB head. And this information is vital, ladies and gentlemen. We are seeing the New World Order really come out in full force. More wars than have been in the last 50 years are going on right now. The war in Chechnya is raging in Grozny with, well, reports of hundreds of thousands dying.
Is that true, folks? Are there more wars going on right now than in the last 50 years? Are there hundreds of thousands of people dying right now in Chechnya? Listen to this. This man is just making it up right out of his head as he goes along.
20 to 40,000 civilians trapped in the city. Russian Hinds are being shot down. Tanks are being blown to bits. Massive Grodd unguided rocket attacks are being launched on the city indiscriminately right now. Air and artillery bombardments as well. It's absolutely out of control. It is pandemic, ladies and gentlemen. I'll give you the news first on Y2K. The newest developments, the Pennsylvania nuclear plant has been shut down. One of the main systems transferring the power from it failed, but they say it's not a Y2K problem. And the things I'm experiencing here in Austin, Texas, the shelves are empty.
In a way, Martin, it was a sort of media war between Bill Cooper and Alex Jones there. But, I mean, Bill's pointing out that a lot of the stuff that Alex is saying is just there to frighten people.
Yeah, I mean, I think what happens is when people start to ask questions outside the mainstream, and then when they start to ask those questions, there's all sorts of diversions for them to trip over. I mean, the idea that Putin is a creature of the IMF, I think, is... When he first came to power, I thought he might be, but in actual fact, he has actually disobeyed
but what he's saying
the orders
there,
from the,
I mean,
from the IMF.
It's classic demonisation. He's saying, yeah, he's actually saying Putin is a demon.
Well, exactly. I mean, Alex Jones is a loose cannon. When people criticise the mainstream, they then go to look for alternative views, but those alternative views are themselves potentially part of the manipulation by the intelligence services.
But he's more recently been talking about getting Muslims out of America. He's been, you know, sort of, I think for a long time there was some credibility to what he said, but he seems to have completely lost it.
Yeah, and there are various people are suggesting that he's, various of his people working with him are working quite closely with Israeli intelligence. I don't know. The point is that we should always keep a sceptical frame of mind when we're dealing with reports of anything, whether it's by the mainstream media or by the so-called alternative media. Well, we need to keep our wits about us at all times.
Well, in that programme, Bill Cooper's programme, part of the Hour of the Time, that he was doing there, criticising Alex Jones and critiquing it, he invited people to phone in, and they did.
Good evening, you're on the air.
Yes, Phil, good evening. Reason why I'm calling, being I live here in New Jersey, kind of reminds me of something that happened, I guess, what, 40, 50 years ago, when there was a radio broadcast that supposedly we were being invaded from Mars.
Oh, yeah.
Into the War of the Worlds.
Uh-huh.
And it pretty much terrorized the metropolitan area here.
It did. What was the name of the city in New Jersey that was featured on that?
Was it Grover's Mill?
Yeah, Grover's Mill. Yeah. All the people in Grover's Mill forgot they even had a water tower. They came out with their guns, and they saw their water tower in the night, in the moonlight, in the starlight, and they thought it was one of the alien tripod machines, and they shot their own city water tower full of holes.
Right. And from just listening to that clip, it just brought me back to remember listening to that show. And it just amazes me that people just don't look out their own window to see what's actually going on.
Yeah, well, I don't think they care.
Yeah.
I think they want something to be going on.
I
think they're waiting for somebody to tell them what to do. I think they're waiting for somebody to whip them up and get their adrenaline going and make fools out of them.
But, you know, some people want that, though.
I know they do.
And
they're called stupid sheeple. How'd you like the way he was whipping up the Christians by calling Putin a demon? Putin is just a human being that happens to live in the Soviet Union and has risen to some position of prominence. We may not like his politics, we may not like his philosophy, but he's just a man like everybody.
Just a man like everybody else. Martin, that broadcast, the radio broadcast, was October the 31st, Halloween 1938. And apparently the nobody connected with the broadcast had any idea it would cause panic. But some people did, didn't they? Harvey Quantrell was involved in the U.S. Psychological Warfare Department.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, basically, people, as any confidence trickster will tell you, people basically want to be deceived. Most of people want to be deceived most of the time that things are all right, and that's how the powers that be get away with an awful lot of stuff. They wouldn't do that sort of thing, would they? But I think the evidence shows that they do these kinds of things, and that they actually spend a lot of time, energy, and resources on working out ways to manipulate people. In a totalitarian system, you don't actually have to bother that much with that. Like the Soviet Union didn't have lots of terrorist attacks which were blamed on dissidents, because the dissidents were already pretty much under the thumb. It's in relatively open societies that the use of psychological warfare takes on its most important aspect. And of course, it was exactly this aspect of using modern media techniques plus terrorism, which was the modus operandi of the fascists before the Second World War, and of people like Reinhard Gehlen and Klaus Barbie after the war, working closely with MI6 and CIA.
So, will you have a happy Halloween? What's the origins of it? How did it come from pagan times?
It's originally Samhain, which is the Celtic New Year, and it was that when the spirits of the dead were able to communicate with the living. So it is, in fact, an ancient, a very ancient.
So what's the connection with all the supermarkets? It's everywhere, isn't it?
Well, I mean, what's happened now is it's become commercialised like Christmas, like anything else. But I mean, it is actually an originally. What was interesting was that the November the 5th gunpowder plot was the Protestant version of Halloween, and that basically is a terrorist false flag attack.
Okay, time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 7. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, Green Councillor for Cotton, Danny Glazard. Thanks also to Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and Will Stone from Avon and Bristol Law Centre. We're online at thisweek.org.uk, where you can get links from this show elsewhere. Do please join us for the politics show at 5 o'clock next week. And don't let the banksters get you down.
Bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.